As you're listening to me, Daisy, Apple's iPhone disassembly robot, is dismantling an iPhone into lots of recyclable parts. That's how Apple recovers more materials than conventional recycling methods. Thanks, Daisy. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Hello and welcome to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. Today we're talking late winners for Aston Villa and Tottenham. We'll also be asking, are Liverpool really titled contenders? And we'll be looking at why Super Sunday was a bit more like Sleepy Sunday. We'll also be looking at diving headers, the art of the diving header with a man who was pretty good at them back in the day. We'll also be looking at rotating goalkeepers. And we'll be chatting about our exclusive interview with Roy Hodgson. And joining me, Tom Clark, for all of that is our two favourite former footballers, Gregor Robertson and Tony Cascarino, and our favourite football writer, Alison Rudd. And just before you think this is terrible management and that I'm alienating the rest of the team, Strictly Come Dancing's back. So that's my Bruce Forsyth tribute. You're all my favourites, after all. I was really hoping for a nice to see you. You know, I thought a teacher left a gap there for them and everything. No, you just honestly, you can't get the staff anymore. But before,
good game.
Yeah, there you go. You see, now you're getting into it. Now we're talking. That's what I want. Honestly, never mind. We should rehearse these things, really, shouldn't we? But before we get into all that, we must go to Old Trafford and the shortest segment in game podcast history, because we're just going to go back and rewind to Thursday's show. Producer Neil, play the clip.
Would we be surprised if the result of the weekend after has gone 3-1 to Brighton, Old Trafford? I wouldn't be surprised.
No, I wouldn't either. No. Absolutely not.
Says it all, really.
Says it all, really, Tony Cascarino. There you go. Brighton 3, Manchester United 1, as we told you on Thursday. So moving on, Liverpool's big win at Wolves. Honestly, it's just laugh a minute with me, isn't it, on a Monday morning. I genuinely did, listeners, say to Gregor, I was like, we could genuinely just play that and move on and be arty, be a bit meta about it. And Gregor was like, no, come on, we've got to talk about it. For God's sake, man. Come on, be serious. So fine, we do. But Tony, not surprised.
My point was more about Brighton winning.
Yeah.
I mean, predicting the actual score is just, that's just guesswork.
How very humble.
I mean, Tom, you've include yourself on this. You've kept the clip in of you saying...
I did, yeah.
Yeah, so, you know, we all sort of agreed...
We're all geniuses, you're right.
Well, no, we all sort of felt, well, no, it wouldn't be a surprise at all, because Man United are a shadow of the club they were many years ago. Even, say, many years, even in recent... If you go back to last season, they look way off what they were last season. In the manner... It was quite weird, because I watched Liverpool and I watched Man United, and Liverpool were way worse in their first half against Wolves than Man United were in the first half. Yet, as the game wore on, the game got stretched. United looked more likely to concede more goals and probably got away with not conceding a fourth and fifth. But there's a lot wrong. I don't think anybody has any doubts in their mind, even the diehard Man United fans, and knowing that their club is in the mire and there is a lot wrong at the football club.
But there's a lot wrong at the football club. And we've talked about it many times on many different podcasts, the list of things that are wrong. Mm. But the shift, I think, in this game was that the fans were not prepared to think, oh, well, you know, poor old Ten Hag operating in a difficult place at a difficult time. They were actively booing his decisions. Mm. I mean, so it's like every level something's wrong, from the history to the ownership to the continued mismanagement at executive level. A lot of problems with individual players, morally included. And now you've got the manager being booed because he chooses to take off a relatively young new striker. That is that's like, what have you got left? I mean, what is the good news?
We are heading into dangerous territory of going into the... We must talk about Brighton here. I can see it coming. I can see it coming. Because I wanted to ask you, Alison, first, because you weren't on Thursday's show, about Brighton and about this performance and about how you view them at the minute. You know, were you in agreement with us when you listened to Thursday's show, thinking Brighton are favourites for this game?
Oh, I nodded along. I mean, you know, in awe of you all, really, thinking I'm not worthy to be in on a Thursday because they're all so clever on a Thursday.
The reality is that she plays tennis and refuses to come in on a Thursday, actually. Big game drama.
Oh, you're ripping open the curtain there.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm not having any of that. But Brighton, they're superb, obviously. They've been brilliant for a long time. You talked about them in the preview show. You thought they were just going to keep going and going. But this performance, does it actually say anything about Brighton other than what we know already? Does it say that they've gone?
Yeah, they're
going beyond?
No, a little bit more, because was it six changes? And you think, hang on a minute. They've already had changes because they had quite a lot of business in the summer, selling players for lots of money that you think of their most famous players. And then they can afford to make six changes on top of that. I mean, how much rotation does that club have in their bank, if you like? And then you hear Jason Steele say afterwards, I thought this was really revelatory, actually, or insightful at least, that he was saying it almost doesn't matter who they sign, because what's the important thing about that player is they buy into what they have going at Brighton and the manager's way of training and their approach and their style and their intensity and their work rate. It's like almost like a cult, and you buy into it. And then on the pitch, you get something that is so much greater than the sum of its parts, because they're buying into a system.
Lewis Dunk said exactly the same thing to us in the mix zone after the Newcastle game about Ansu Fati's arrival. He's saying, like, it's going to be an eye-opener for him. But if he's open-minded and if he works hard and he sort of buys into what everyone else has had to do here, then he'll love it. He'll have a great time. I think this game underlined everything that Brighton have that Manchester United don't. And, like, part of that is... Yeah, they can make six changes and there's still such a clear vision and idea, and whoever steps in knows the roles in the system. Tarek Lamptey can play at left back. But then also, Mahmoud Dahoud was the only De Zerbi signing. So it's also about the succession planning and all the things that we've spoken about for so long, about De Zerbi came in and he's largely worked with the same group of players and he's brought them on to a new level. And from... You know, I'm going to speak about Manchester United quickly here, because I still stand by what I said on Thursday about Ten Hag, and that any manager would be undermined by what's going on around them at Manchester United and by the sort of oppressive weight of all the crap above them. And, you know, I was thinking, you look at the joyous scenes at the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium this weekend and the impact that someone like Ange Postecoglou has done. Do we think if we transferred Postecoglou in to Old Trafford, he could have had the same impact? And there was a lot of stuff going on at Spurs too. I think there's such a rotten core at that club. And I'll say it again, as long as the Glazers are owners of Manchester United, it will be impossible for anyone to fully break free of that.
I think it's really an eye-opener. When you look at the downfall of Barcelona with all the money and how they were spending it, and, you know, just players coming in with huge salaries, Man United have had quite a bit of that as well. If you take it even to Alexis Sanchez, that came into the club, you know, moves that were all based on Paul Pogba getting huge money. And then you see De Gea's contract and you see Marcus Rashford signed, and there's been a lot of failure all the way around, and yet players seem to get the crown jewels when they join Man United. Some of them getting renewed contracts, people like Phil Jones. It feels like there's a lot that's going on that I don't know how... Barcelona did all this. They had Dembele, you know, on a huge contract. They had Coutinho on a huge contract and many others. And it was really weird from the outside, thinking they're not the club they were once upon a time, but they're giving everybody loads of money. And Man United feel like they're the Christmas club, where they just keep giving out presents to everybody without... Fernandes signed a new deal. You know, yes, he did well in the first season. He gets the captaincy. I don't get all the decisions. And again, probably echoing what Greg was saying, I wouldn't go totally on Ten Hag, but a lot of the signings already look like They're not delivering to the expectation that's required of that football club.
You're spot on, you know, because what the Man United are, they're like someone, billionaire's son, who has no mates and no social skills and thinks, but I'm having a party, so I'm going to have to pay people to come to my party. Whereas you've got Brighton, who have loads of mates, don't need to pay anyone to come to the party. And in fact, get away with only serving sausage rolls because everyone's going to have an amazing time and the music's going to be groovy.
Remember, you've got a Northerner and a Scot on this podcast. There's nothing wrong with a sausage roll at a party. If anything,
laughing.
That's the highlight.
I'm laughing because Alison invited me round to her Christmas party.
It's all coming out now.
Well, I didn't pay you to come, did I?
But I mean, lots of interesting points raised there. But do we, Gregor, kind of slightly back to you on the kind of slight defence of Ten Hag, because, you know, everyone's talking about Brighton and they've only spent this much on their team in comparison to Man United, and your point about Postecoglou is the same and applies to De Zerbi as well. If you put him in at Old Trafford, it wouldn't immediately be the same. But Ten Hag has been there. This isn't his first season. It's not a case of him saying, oh, he's playing with other people's players, as per the point you made about De Zerbi. There's two elements here, aren't there, in terms of bad management, bad transfer signings that Tony highlights. But you would expect to see a little bit more on the pitch in terms of a manager who's had a time with a group, has played Brighton a couple of times now already, knows what you're going to get. Or am I being too harsh? You know, Tony said they played well in the first half and then just kind of dropped off. But am I not right to expect a little bit more from Ten Hag in these situations? Are the United fans not allowed to boo a few decisions? And also still be angry at the ownership.
Yeah, look, ultimately, you know, a manager can only go for so long without you seeing some positive effects, and you know, the buck will stop with him. I think it's easy to think, you know, it's easy to think you could transplant someone else in there and they would have an impact. And because we've seen someone like De Zerbi be so impactful in the way they play, I just think you can't underestimate the sort of oppressive atmosphere at that club. And also the kind of maybe the culture, and he's spoken about these things and the things that there are in the changing room, possibly some egos, possibly, you know, some people who've been there too long, some people who think that they should be playing when they're not, like all these things. Whereas it's like, that's why he keeps talking about the thing that that people can't buy from Brighton is their culture and their spirit. Mm. And that's, it's so important, like no matter, at every level, like even at the very top level, you cannot have an atmosphere that is, you know, that is not conducive to success, because it ultimately doesn't mean that players can get the, you know, can draw the most out of themselves. It doesn't make a sort of collective team spirit. All these things are the things that we've seen repeatedly. Manchester United like flicker, like to kind of almost tease us, thinking that they're getting somewhere, but they're always dragged back into this.
Yeah, Tony, do you think then that Gregor's right? You know, you used the word oppressive there. And it's interesting because, you know, I grew up in Manchester. A lot of my friends, my brother's a Man United fan. The very simple description they often give is that they're really slow. They look much slower than everyone else. Is there a sense that kind of the overhanging clouds that have been on the club for so long can genuinely affect a player, Tony?
Yeah, I've said to you, and I think I've said to you this before on this podcast, I'm always concerned about the way that Dutch football has been played. Mm. Because they were one of the leaders of European football for a number of years with their brilliant style, fantastic technical players. But they could also do one thing that this United team can't, is they could match you physically. And I look at a very slow-paced game at times. Ten Hag can't get off scot-free. I understand all the problems around, but I do think one of the most professional players that's ever been in the game is Ronaldo. And he raised these concerns in the early stages of Ten Hag, yet Ten Hag decided to go up against him and thought he was a real problem at the football club. Now, you know, we can look back, and I sort of think maybe, yeah, Ronaldo has got that incredible ego. It's been part of, but you could never accuse him of not being professional as his fitness and the way he's, you know, you don't get to 37, 38 in the way he's looked after himself. And he obviously saw a lot of this going on at Old Trafford. You know, we've seen what's happened with Pogba in recent weeks, and you have to go back again and you think, this club has been run so strangely for a club, you know.
That predates Ten Hag, though.
Yes, it does.
Ronaldo can bring those points up, but that doesn't mean the decision to get rid of him wasn't the correct
one. No, I've always had this thing in my head about because I've worked on Dutch football and I looked at it and I keep thinking there's a lot of Dutch players who come over who don't match up to the physical side. They play at Ajax play one way, and every club in Holland nearly plays the same way, which they basically, no one will dare play two up front. Everyone plays a possession base with no pressing at all. And I don't look at United's pressing as a pressing of sorts. It's Brian got round their press really easy, especially in the second half. It was a looking over your shoulder, are you going to follow me in? And it's and I think it's a lot of that
going on. It
seems
to be working. And I don't know when that's part with United and Ten Hag, and the kind of the plan A sometimes works.
Yes, sometimes.
But then a team like De Zerbi and Brighton, who are clever, adapt to it, and United don't adapt back, because that seemed to be the case with the pressing. It was working, and then all of a sudden Brighton were playing around them, and United went, "Hang on a minute, I thought we'd cracked it." What?
Yeah.
Well, didn't seem able to react.
Alisson mentioned about obviously Højbjerg coming off and Højlund coming off, and when he came off. You know, most fans would go, well, look, he's been injured. He hasn't played. He's missed the start of the season. They understand from the manager. But the fans were more like, well, no, this is just a decision. We need a goal and we're desperate for getting it. You know, and the frustration, there's a lot going on at that football club and it's so complex. I don't think anyone, even Ten Hag, even if he got half the decisions right that's happened so far, they'd still be in a situation of not being challenging the leading clubs in the Premier League. I just don't see it at the moment. Mm. There's bleaker days ahead for Man United, that's for sure.
Yeah, the booing was partly because the fans want a good news story. They wanted a sort of fairy tale. Yeah. They wanted something nice to happen that they could cling to.
What a new talisman.
This is the future. We spent a lot of money on a young striker. His arrival, you know, on the scene is a bit delayed by his back issue, but he looked okay against
Was against Arsenal, wasn't it? That was the positive when they lost to Arsenal.
Yeah,
it was.
Okay.
Will Hoyland looked quite good.
Yeah, looked quite like he's not going to be held back by his injury. And he played okay against Brighton. Didn't look intimidated by it. Looked like he was growing into the role. I mean, the fans are clearly prepared to give him time to get used to the team and so on. But then to haul him off, the fans felt denied
more
that sense of that little flicker of optimism. It's like, oh, well, we don't want Martial again. Don't want that again.
Yeah.
You also got to look at, like, United had Reguilon playing left back. It was like a panic loan signing for left back. Mm. So you have Johnny Evans on the bench, like Lindelof still playing at centre half. And you look at, as we've already mentioned, the succession plan and Brighton signing several midfield players when they knew they were selling McAllister and Caicedo. Like, there is still fundamentally an absolutely enormous gulf between the sort of intelligence of the running of a club like Brighton and every club, really, in the Premier League, but Manchester United particularly so.
Yeah, I mean, worrying times for Erik ten Hag and Manchester United, but I want to finish on Brighton with this one. And Alisson, again, on Thursday we talked about how far they can go. I think in the season preview you talked about top six. Could you see going any higher? They've obviously got their debut in Europe this week against AEK Athens.
I'm not going to say they can't go higher. I just think it's realistic. And with your first ever campaign in Europe, I think you should be happy with top six and doing well in Europe. And I think that would be a fantastic season for them.
Absolutely. Incredibly exciting times for Brighton. Slightly worrying for Manchester United, but I'm sure it won't be the last time we say those words on the Game podcast. Another team we're getting excited about, or maybe not, Gregor, is Liverpool. You were at their win against Wolves, and you were chatting with me before the show. Bloody headline writers are overselling my piece. I came in. I was off on Sunday, so, you know, all the bad headlines get through when I'm off on the editing desk. But Gregor, you'd written a piece about, are Liverpool contenders? Are they?
Well, that seems to be the kind of growing consensus, the view that's like, you know, this is getting quite exciting because there's a steely edge now to Liverpool. They kind of come back from having gone behind in three of their games to win them. And there still just seems to me a lot of issues that Liverpool have to confront. And yeah, that's, you know, that's a positive. But I think more than a steely edge, that's actually because of the wealth of options they have on the bench now in attacking areas and the changes and how impactful they've been in game substitutes. Sometimes a tweak of formation. Klopp changed to 4-4-2 at half time in this game. In fact, it was more like 4-2-4. And he went for it and had four attackers on the pitch, dropped Szoboszlai back into kind of holding number six position, and he was brilliant in the second half. But there's still massive questions about the balance in midfield for me. I don't know who the ball winner is.
Do you agree with Tony that they were poor in the first half?
They were awful.
Yeah.
Woeful. Mm. Not poor. Woeful. Like, they weren't... There was no energy. There was no bite. There was no, like, cohesion. Klopp just kept kind of throwing his arms around and like, what's going on? And he berated Cody Gakpo when, for Wolves' goal, the opening goal, he there was a long throw into the box by, I think, Curtis Jones. And he kind of... threw a leg out at it, miscontrolled it, and they broke away with Neto, who was outstanding, and scored the opener. And Klopp said, you know, I think some of his quotes were brilliant. He said it looked like we'd met in the car park for the first time before the game. And he said, like, what? So he was asked, what were you thinking at half time? He was like, WTF. And, like, you know, it was awful. And yes, they were better in the second half, but it's also, you know, it's the old Roy Keane thing. It's easy to play when you're one. When you're 1-0 down. I know Alison and I have had some disagreements about that in the past, but it is, they're like, you throw the shackles off, particularly you throw on a few of your subs. I don't know how sustainable that is, and B, as I say, I'll come back to it, the balance in midfield, I still don't see who the ball winner is. And Wolves had a player in João Gomes who was outstanding at that. He won, I think, 6 tackles, more than any player on the pitch. Wolves are really intelligent about kind of holding a low block, and then not being drawn out by Liverpool, and then just when they played a forward pass, they would snap into it, win little pressing triggers, win the ball back, and go on the break, and they could have been 2 or 3 up at half time. And also at the back, the Trent Alexander-Arnold wasn't playing in this game. He's got a hamstring injury, but Klopp asked Joe Gomez to play the same sort of role and step into midfield. You know that we've seen Trent do it. And how much when they went back to 4 at the back, we saw, you know, Andy Robertson was let off the leash, and we saw what kind of how he's been sort of shackled by this desire to move Trent into midfield, which is really because he's not good enough defensively. There's just a lot of balancing sort of act questions for me about Liverpool. Yes, they've got so much talent and so much attacking power now, firepower and potential in going forward, but the other way, not sure.
But be honest.
Classic politician's answer from Gregor.
No,
Alison.
No, but be honest, Gregor.
It's fairly clear.
If you can be honest, did you at any point in that first half think Liverpool were going to lose this match?
Absolutely.
Really? Well, see, I didn't.
You're a Liverpool
It was fan. A lunchtime. It was a lunchtime kickoff. Liverpool don't like them. Have too many of them, and it's become a bit of an issue at the club, and especially lunchtime kickoffs after an international break. And Klopp hadn't even had a cup of tea with half the players. That has an impact. The mere fact that they can get all that jet lag and lack of cohesion out of their system in the first 45 minutes and at halftime, Klopp is capable of turning it around so that they come out and look like a team that could challenge Manchester City for the title. That says a lot, I think, to be able to absorb. And it was an appalling first half performance. The ball was given away and then it was given away again and then it was given away again. And the midfield looked a mess. I agree completely. But the fact that he's got access to so much now for a club that was sort of like getting that label of, well, you know, can they actually compete with someone like Man City? Because they haven't got 2 players for every position. They actually look like they almost have. And he can rejig it, Klopp. And I thought, whilst accepting it was an abysmal first half performance, and also there's that sort of game management knowledge, you know, Wolves just ran out of puff, and I kind of knew that was going to happen as well.
Yeah, look, you knew that Wolves had to get another goal. Yeah, you know, they couldn't keep up that
Cunha's chance.
Oh,
it's a great chance.
Just before half time, unbelievable chance. He just mistimed misjudged whether he had to jump or not, and it's like. Then it fell at a position between his foot and, you know, even his chest. He couldn't do anything with it. They had chances, yeah. And like I say, Liverpool had no ideas in the first half. And you expected them to improve in the second, but I'm just not sure about the defence. Joel Matip, and you look at Van Dijk coming back, and that used to be like, oh, Van Dijk's coming back. Now it doesn't really fill you with confidence that they're going to keep enough clean sheets. I think they'll score enough goals. They won't score as many goals as Man City. No one does. They'll score enough goals to be within reach of challenging for the title. I don't think they'll keep enough out.
Tony, your response to all that?
Liverpool were as woeful as I think I can remember, I think Napoli would probably be the standout game in the Champions League last season, where they were unbelievably bad in the first half. Obviously, Neto, I said before the game, up against Gomez, bit of a mismatch, had him on toast, 45 minutes. Gomez didn't know what to do with Neto. Luckily for Liverpool, he didn't have the same impact. Liverpool have got speed and they can change it, obviously with Nunes and Diaz coming on.
Harvey Elliott too was good.
Yeah, Harvey Elliott done really well as well, yeah. The three subs were big, and they were really big at St James's Park as well, that turned the game around. McAllister clearly had jet lag. I mean, he got back Friday morning. I talked about Casemiro and jet lag and Matt McAllister. McAllister had a parachute on his back. He kept giving away the ball. If you're going to give away the ball in that position, which is, was normally being the last man, you're in trouble. And it suited Wolves. That's why he came off immediately after 45 minutes, because Klopp has like looked at him and thought, I can't leave him on. He hasn't got the legs to get round. So there was many, many issues in that first half. I don't think Liverpool will challenge this year. And I'm looking at the next two away games, and it's Spurs away and Brighton away in the Premier League. You know, their next two away games. And I do think there are games in between, but I do think that we'll know a lot more about where Liverpool are, because I was not convinced by that victory. I wasn't really convinced about the Newcastle victory, because Nunes took two goals so brilliantly well. You are not going to win goals by strikers doing that week in, week out, because they're unbelievable finishes. So I think the one big positive I've took out of it was Mo Salah. His involvement in the game, as in not playing particularly great, but being a nuisance and finding passes. You know, he's done, again, and boop, the goal for Robertson got. The little intricate pass, he's just weighted it brilliantly. And he did it in the opening game of the season at Stamford Bridge against Chelsea. A similar ball that, you know, OK, a bit more cover, a bit more distance. But Liverpool are not a side that have made me feel, even though it's the cover of ball, I'm not convinced they're going to be, certainly not challenging for the title this year.
Gregor, just a final word on Wolves. We're obviously impressed with that defeat at Manchester United, first game, but we thought, hey, hang on a minute, they look like they've got something about them. Do you still feel that? They're 16th at the minute. Do you think they'll be in the relegation scrap or higher?
I don't think they'll be far clear of it.
Yeah.
But that's largely because they are, because of their inability to score goals. Cunha, if Cunha could put the ball in the back of the net, he'd be playing for, you know, Man United or maybe Liverpool.
Don't give him that awful thing.
No, it's true, because the way he can, he's such a good ball carrier. And on those moments in the break in transition where it was him and Neto, it was only him and Neto, and they caused absolute havoc. And he's really direct. He's got, yeah, he's exciting to watch, but he's missed a lot of chances already this season. And you just struggle to see where the goals are coming from. I just watched this again and thought, I think, like, Gary O'Neill could be something. He could be something, I think, as a manager. He's got a really sharp mind, and you could see him on the touchline. Just about little things about, you know, if Cunha perhaps switched off when they were trying to hold that really rigid sort of disciplined structure and only go to win the ball back at the moments that they'd worked on. And maybe he kind of drifted out and he was going crazy on the sidelines. All those little details you see, and it worked, but they just didn't have enough to continue it for the full 90 minutes. And also they didn't have enough when Liverpool brought in the cavalry from the bench.
If you look at Wolves, they've had over the last few years a number of players that on their day are unplayable, like Adama Traore. You know, you see him and you think, oh, he's unreal, he's just got unbelievable pace. Cunha, Neto, they've had these types of players that when you see them, and you are right, they could play at the very highest level, but it's only in and out, it's only every now and again.
Yeah.
Now I look at Neto and I think, Joe Gomez, well, if you ask him after the game, one of the toughest wingers he's played against, why many, he'd probably go, oh, don't, Neto. He's so difficult to know which way he's going to go. But that typifies sort of Wolves to me. And I think that's one of Gary O'Neill's biggest challenges, is that getting consistency from very good footballers that they have at their club, it can't be just every now and again.
Yeah. A little bit of hope for Wolves then. We're going to talk more about some of Saturday's action in the second half of the show, but I wanted to discuss Sleepy Sunday. And given the matches and given some of the scorelines, we'll try and whiz through it quite quickly. As an editor, you sometimes worry which writers you've got at which games when it's nil-nil. But one writer that I can always rely on to produce the goods is Alison Rudd. You were at Bournemouth-Chelsea, Alison. I don't want to dwell too much on Chelsea because they're a club we've talked about a lot, and I feel like slightly similarly to Manchester United, you look at it and go, well, as you said in your report, they can't work out how to score goals. Tell us first what your impression was of Bournemouth, because as much as your stats in your piece that you highlight aren't necessarily good for them as well, point at home is quite impressive against one of the bigger teams that have spent a lot of money, isn't it?
In isolation, yes, it sounds like a good result. But they're a bit like Wolves, but not quite as good as Wolves. That's the problem. They can't score. They have a philosophy which is, I don't know, I think at the moment you can probably divide the Premier League into clubs who have managers whose philosophy is to be attacking and reckless and entertaining and
organised chaos.
Quite like chaos.
Yeah, that's what he's...
And Bournemouth are one of those. Areola is one of those managers. So, actually, I felt they were quite well disciplined in that they pressed high. So, the Chelsea back four were always under some sort of pressure. There were quite a lot of cherry shirts going for it in that sense, which you'd think, and you sort of thought, oh, well, Pochettino knows this is going to happen, so he set up his team to try and make use of the gaps that Bournemouth must inevitably leave. But they were very disciplined at getting players back into position and defending. They defended well, actually. There was only a couple of times when they were exposed. So it wasn't so much chaotic this time. There was a balance between going for it, and they grew in confidence because I think they probably showed a little bit of respect initially to Chelsea. Then it became pretty clear that Chelsea were in an emotionally negative state. It was a very strange game. I made the analogy in my piece that, you know, it used to be like Chelsea would be like, oh, I'm going to a wedding and I'm really looking forward to seeing all my favourite cousins, and there's that aunt and uncle I haven't seen for ages. And then, but you end up at this Chelsea team and you stand up for the toast and you don't recognise anybody in the marquee, because it's just like, who are Chelsea? What are they?
You definitely wouldn't recognise the bench.
No, it was ridiculous. Ridiculous. And they had 12 important players out.
But even when you look through those 12 important players, are they all important? Like,
well, if they were all fit and knew each other and had they look like a group of strangers, partly because they are. There's no cohesion.
You talk about that lack of cohesion. We mentioned earlier with Eric Ten Hag having been at Manchester United for a long time. Obviously, Mauricio Pochettino hasn't been at Chelsea for a long time. Are you seeing any seeds of hope, any bit reason to be optimistic in terms of their play, in terms of their tactics, in terms of the things he is responsible for?
Well, not really. And I don't know. If I was Pochettino, I would not be sleeping well, because I don't know how you get a team to gel when you have this relentless conveyor belt of injuries. It's peculiar, and I don't think it's... Everyone goes, and Pochettino himself said, you know, what am I going to do, cry about it? I've got to handle the injuries. But I think there's something... We have talked about Chelsea's owners perhaps not knowing what they're doing. I don't think they've employed the right people in the sports science department, because there's so much high-tech analysis now and ways of preventing injury that if you are run properly as a club, I've written about this because I wrote about artificial intelligence in football, and one of the things I touched upon was, and I only touched upon this because it's mainly about tactics, but is that you identify just from the way a player runs in training or in a match, you can identify where he might be about to pick up an injury, and you stop that injury happening or becoming serious.
God, I wish there was that in my
and you know your priority as a sports science unit is to make sure that players who cost a lot of money are not missing half the season because they pick up a hamstring or whatever, and there are ways of doing that, and you can go through the clubs that you think are well run and have recruited well in those sort of tech departments. It's not just a run of bad luck that Chelsea have this conveyor belt of injuries. They're not doing it right. They're not picking it. they're not picking up early enough the potential for there to be an injury. So that I think that's part of the flaws of the new ownership, actually. And that's, but it's not Pochettino's fault. That's not his department. No. That's not what he does. He has to deal with it. But I did struggle to see patterns. I struggled to see, and he did too. I mean, he moaned about where the fullbacks were. Well, it's, surely he's told them where to be. It was mostly because they weren't an integrated team. They didn't, you know. We talked about six changes made by Brighton, but everybody knew their role. These changes, they're enforced changes, and it's not the system, it's not the starting 11 Pochettino would like, or anywhere close. So every single player looked like they were filling in for someone else, as opposed to feeling they were part of a project or a pattern. And they emanated hesitancy and negativity most of the game.
Tony, quickly from you on Chelsea.
I've been a Chelsea player and I've had a lot of contact with people within the club. There's been massive change inside the club as well. And it's not just in one department that Al's talking about, you know, on avoiding injuries. It's to do with it across the board at Chelsea. There's huge change. Hardly anybody knows anybody in any department at Chelsea at the moment. I find it really strange, as in Poch feels like he's a coach that he's got to do a lot of work on individual players. Whether it's Nicholas Jackson, you know, as a centre forward, you know, he had the luxury at PSG of having some great strikers, and he did at Spurs as well. And he probably didn't have to spend that much time working on Harry Kane, but he did in the early stages. But he didn't have to once he got him to be the player. I feel like Mudryk is a player that he's probably going to think, oh, I've got to work on him and his individual stuff. You know, he's up against Max Aarons in the game. You know, young lad who's been in the Championship and, yeah, played Premier League football, highly thought of, right back. And he looked clueless how to get past him, you know. And it was a bit of a common theme. I just feel he's a manager that will probably say, I need to work on 6-7 players individually about how they fit into a team, and it works. And some of them he might already have made his mind up. I'm not, you know, they're not for me. But I've got such a long injury list that, you know, I can't resolve these problems. I think it's a bit like we talked about with Ten Hag about, you know, and Gregor was saying, you know, I'm not sure how much Poch can do to improve what is already happening at the club. They are so ordinary in so many positions. I mean, it was a snooze fest yesterday. You know, watching that game was just, oh, what? Someone said to me, well, what are you going to talk about? I'd say, well, I don't know really, because...
Better leave it there then. Better leave it there then. Moving on. Go on, you're going to have to make this good.
I've had the same thought for a year watching Chelsea. How on earth have they spent this money? And this is the team on the pitch. Like, you can see, you know, okay, they've got... I don't think all those players, you talk like 12 players, they're not all players that you'd put in their first team. You'd put in Caicedo. You'd probably put in Wesley Fofana, Reece James, and Nkunku. That's four. Maybe Lavia, but he's an unknown yet. Yeah. So like, they're all players that are, everyone's unknown. Mm. They all are like, as I said so many times, they got rid of a Champions League winning team and replaced it at the cost of £1 billion with potential. And this is like, it's gobsmacking to look. They've got Brighton's old reserve goalkeeper playing between the sticks, like a bench full of kids that you've never heard of. And I'm sure they're talented, and I'm sure, you know, one or two of them we might see soon. But again, they've spent £1 billion and that's what's on the pitch. It's extraordinary.
Gregor's verging on losing the plot here, so I am going to move on because we want to talk about Everton Arsenal. See if we can talk about that for as long as we did a 0-0 that was supposedly really boring. But just two very quick questions on that. Tony, in your column today, you said that Everton are a bad version of Sean Dyche's Burnley. Tell us more about what you think about that.
Well, it was more to do with how their style is set up. And I don't have a problem with styles. I'm not one who thinks you can only play this way to be successful. I think the laws in the game make you have to be more adventurous, which, OK, but there's still an argument for teams that can keep clean sheets and make it difficult, and they can win enough football matches. This Everton team is nowhere near as close as Sean Dyche's Burnley team. You know, if you think of Ashley Barnes and Chris Wood,
they all
bought into the way they played, and they did it quite effective. You know, they were quite effective by the way they did it. And you look at Everton in this particular game is that it felt like they had to get to the last 10 minutes or get to 1-0 down before they were going to play the Burnley way, which is to get it fast forward and Pickford booms it every time he gets the ball. But they don't even do that well. They couldn't do what Ashley Barnes and Chris Wood did, you know, for that football club. So I that was my point, is this is a really big football club. In the history of, you know, football, not just Premier League, but going back to the old Division One, this club has been around for a long time, had lots of great sides, been successful, and now I'm watching a side that feel like, to me, they play like a team who's got promoted from the Championship, get to the Premier League and don't quite know which way they're going to play until they get there. And I just feel it's now looks like a flawed idea. And Sean Dyche is probably, deep down, if I'm sure if you went and asked Sean Dyche afterwards and say, your Burnley team and that Everton team, he'd go, no, my Burnley team were better. They were better. They were more effective. They could do it. The things I asked them to do and the way I wanted to play were way, way more suitable. This Everton team, three boys in midfield, Decore, 40 million, okay? 6'3", 6'4", can carry, get forward. Anana, same thing. You know, 35 million, I don't know exactly what he was. Idrissa Gueye, been about three powerful athletic midfielders. None of them could get on the ball and make anything happen. You know, that's your engine room.
Yeah.
And I just found them a very, very poor version of Burnley. That was what was my, you know, my take on it.
Yeah. Worries on the pitch for Everton, and obviously lots of talk off the pitch about their takeover. You can read Martin Samuel's Monday morning column on that topic and on ownership in football generally on the Times website. Now, moving on from Everton, I just want to ask one quick question on Arsenal, which is in relation to Mikel Arteta's comments after the game, talking about change of goalkeeper, David Raya coming in place of Aaron Ramsdale. Arteta talking not only about changing goalkeeper and having two number ones during a season, but also the potential for changing goalkeepers during a match as well. Gregor, former defender, you'd love that, wouldn't you? Change the bloke behind you.
Yeah, he's an innovator, isn't he? Yeah. Miguel. I mean,
he's a water-ater.
you know, I was thinking about this earlier, and I was like, oh, you know, all my natural instincts are to say, God, no, you want a settled back four, you want to know the guy behind you, you want relationships, you know, all that kind of stuff. But that's pretty much kind of been ebbed away and eroded in the modern game because of the sheer volume of football that's being played.
Well, if you know your role, as we said with Brighton, it shouldn't matter.
So, you know, fundamentally, that's the truth. And I think if you were to give me the choice, and actually if you were probably to give most footballers the choice, particularly defenders, they would want to have a settled back 4-3 whatever and goalkeeper for that reason. But then they also know that they're playing 60-65 games a season, and so, you know, they can probably now understand why there is an urge to rotate more. So, my instinct was to say something that probably makes me sound like a dinosaur. Having said that, changing midway through a game, I don't see any reason for that. I think he's probably gone too far down a little Mikel path there.
can I just make a point here? I was thinking about this and thinking on the way in about, has there ever been a scenario where two goalkeepers are arguably the number one, and it's really rare to find? I kept thinking, well, Shilton and Clements for England. That was like that for a little while. But Shilton was number one, really the number one. And I find it hard to think how you can make an argument that says, you know, if you look at every club, we could probably say who's everybody's number one.
Yeah.
And it can change because of, obviously, form. But
you'll always be able to choose by who's plays in the biggest games too.
Yeah.
Realise. So, you know, he didn't really explain why you would change a goalkeeper midway through a game. What is it, suddenly because you need to have someone who's better on the ball, like, and,
well, potentially,
tactical,
you never
decisions
know. Yeah.
Yeah.
Experience, penalty saving, the old Louis van Gaal with Tim Krul in a World Cup. Just very quickly, I'm not going to ask you who's the better goalkeeper, but I'm going to ask you who you prefer as a player of the two of them, Ramsdale or Raya, for all of you. Just one word answer. Gregor? Raya?
Raya.
Oh yeah, Raya.
Interesting,
but
isn't it?
Maybe there is method
to Mikel's madness. I prefer Raya as well, as for what
it's
worth.
Because the number one characteristic I want in a goalkeeper was calm and composure, and Ramsdale doesn't have that.
Yeah, but you're only allowed one word. You cheated, but anyway.
In all the discussion of should you do this to your, should you treat your goalkeeper like any other outfield player and just say, oh no, I'm going to sub you, whatever. For all my entire life, I grew up believing that goalkeepers were different psychologically, that their profile was different. And it's a really, really exposed position. It's a really hard position to have on the pitch. a striker can miss a sitter, you forget. But if the goalkeeper lets something in, he should save it. It's poured over. It's really hard. You are so exposed.
Scrutinised more.
Yeah, absolutely. And so part of the reason for establishing yourself as the number one is that it gives you a breathing space and a sense of composure and confidence, so that you, all those demons you've got going in you, in, you know, should I punch the ball? Should I catch the ball? Oh, did I let that go? You know, all the things that can really mess with your head, you get over them because you know you've got the faith of the manager in you and your team in you, and you're known as the number one. And it is a different position. And some strikers are known as the number one, but mostly, you know, it's the thing that you talk about, the keeper. And it's, but the thing is, the point I'm raising is there's a reason for that that has evolved. And are we now, is Arteta now saying he doesn't believe goalkeepers should have a different psyche to anyone else?
That is interesting. Like, why, you know, that's a fundamentally his point. Why are you asking me about him and not Gabriel Jesus, who has won more trophies than anyone else in the team and me? That's what his answer was. Like, so he's essentially eroding that you know, the line that Alisson was saying has been drawn for time immemorial between goalkeepers. And he's saying it's not 10, he said it's not 10 plus 1.
Yeah.
So
interesting. Well, unlike Mikel Arteta, I won't be making any changes for the second half of the podcast because you're all performing brilliantly. So stick with us. We're going to be talking diving headers and those late winners, and also a little bit of Roy Hodgson.
iOS helps you control which apps you share your exact location with. There's more to iPhone.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Burrow is a furniture company known for timeless design and thoughtful construction, and free shipping, and that extends to their outdoor collection. Their outdoor furniture is built to withstand the elements, featuring rust-proof stainless steel hardware, weather-ready teak, and quick-dry foam cushions. For Memorial Day, get 15% off your Burrow purchase at burrow.com/acast, and up to 25% off outdoor. That's up to 25% off outdoor furniture at burrow.com/acast.
Welcome back to the Game Football Podcast from The Times. We are going straight to West Ham Stadium and Tony Cascarino's love of a diving header. James Ward-Prowse pulling one out of the bag to give West Ham the lead, and everyone thinking, oh gosh, they might do it. They might do it. This would be so David Moyes, but sadly not. So we're not going to dwell on another win for Manchester City, but Tony, in your column, you talked about the love of the diving header and a bit of a dying art for you.
Well, you rarely see them. I actually picked it as goal of the weekend. I get asked to do this sometimes, pick a goal of the weekend, and I picked that because I just, as he scored it, I remember thinking Millwall at Gillingham at Priestfield, and I scored a diving header against Millwall, and Big Sam Allardyce was the centre-half, and I got across him and had a diving header and put it in the bottom corner. And it was one of my favourite goals, of you know, and you just don't see them.
But it's not for sentimental reasons that you like it, isn't it? In your column, you talked about the benefits of them as a move.
Yes.
You talked about this modern thing of players, cross comes in, player thinks, I'm going to bring this down, trap
take a
it,
touch.
And
yeah.
you know, whereas you're like, throw yourself at it, and not only do you get there ahead of everyone, you're probably going to score before the goalkeeper, right?
Yeah, well, the goalkeeper can't get set.
Yeah.
Or, you know, with a touch, you know, microsecond, you take a touch, a defender can get to you, or a goalkeeper can set himself for the shot that you're going to take. Diving header, it's a bit like a toe punt. You know the old toe punt run in Dino where suddenly he shoots and it's gone past him in the bottom corner.
Yeah.
That's what a diving header is. Because you're taking it so early and you're firing yourself at it, and it's really hard to get the right direction as well. It's not like you go, I'm going to pick that bottom corner. You just meet it. You know, and it always flies off your head. So it comes off really quickly. Yeah. And a goalkeeper could have it literally next to him. It can still go past him. So I just love the fact that James Ward-Prowse, you know, he showed a bit of agility, and also having that in his mindset. I started to think, when was the last one I saw? I remember Cavani doing it at Southampton for Man United, scoring a goal with a diving header. But it's sort of something, look, Andy Gray, speciality of Andy Gray. He loved the diving header when he was at Wolves and Everton. But there were very few. So to me, it was a bit refreshing to just see that type of goal.
There you are, listeners. Not often you'll hear Tony Cascarino, Ronaldinho and James Ward-Prowse mentioned in the same breath. But listen, I'm here for it. Gregor, just quickly from the defender's point of view, is Tony right that a diving header, if a striker goes early and goes in front of you when you're thinking, oh, I'm going to hook this away, is it a more difficult art to defend against?
Yeah, anything that's kind of instinctive or on the stretch like that as well. And if they're, because a striker always has the sort of the chance to make the decision of what they're going to do before, you know, you're reacting to it rather than making the main protagonist. Yeah. So also when you're going with the head, it's a risk to clear it, to go with your foot. It's like you're more at risk of giving away a penalty. So yeah, they're a bit of a dying art, and it was a great goal, and it's also brave.
Yeah,
I think you even see a lot of people not just trying to take a touch, they also try and kind of manoeuvre their body to get their foot on it, even if it's a volley first time. So yeah, it was a great goal to see.
Hopefully we'll see more of them. Now I'm going to take you back to Saturday morning. I was getting on my train from King's Cross to go to Lincoln's game, which we drew, if anyone's interested, against Carlisle. Not a thriller, not going to talk any more about that, almost as boring as Sleepy Sunday. But what I did see at King's Cross Station was loads and loads of Sheffield United fans down for the big trip to the Tottenham Hotspur Stadium. By all accounts, the great ground that you want to go to. And then when I got in the car after full time at Sintel Bank, I looked at their score and I thought, you poor buggers. Deary me. You've made that trip down. They were in great voice. This was 10 a.m. in the morning. You know, get into the pub, have a few drinks, get excited. You think you might win 1-0. Heartbreaking. What does this say about Tottenham, though? In terms of the excitement, we don't want to dwell too much on it because we've talked about Ange Postecoglou and the brilliant start he's had. But does this tell us anything more? And obviously a goal for Richarlison as well. In the week he talked about, you know, having difficulties off the pitch, needing some time, potentially away from the game. Comes on, scores. Alison, are we seeing something, a different type of Tottenham? Not so Spursy.
Well, the thing that Postecoglou likes to praise the most is the way his players react and their resilience. So if they do go behind, he likes the way that they don't crumble or crumple. Which one's better? Both probably work. But he doesn't praise the flair or the pace or so much. He always praises their character. And so that's quite clever of him, I think, because it means the next time they go behind, they'll think, oh, we're really good at fighting back, and they'll keep doing it. And yes, it was slightly cringy the way the fans celebrated, like it was a piece of silverware. It was only Sheffield United, and how come it took them so long to break them down? But the fact that they kept plugging away, and they kept a bounciness to them. You know, there was none of that drooping shoulders. He has instilled a belief there, which is the Spurs must be absolutely fantastic to see. But am I allowed to mention Paul Heckingbottom?
Yes, that was going to be my next. That was my next question. You do it for me. It's fine.
Well, no, just that I do feel like the overwhelming sense is that Paul Heckingbottom was just whinging as a losing manager afterwards and creating conspiracy theories that the officials were against him. I actually think if you step back and analyse what he said, there's a lot in it that's quite complex and more interesting than it being a conspiracy theory. He was saying the referees were sort of, the officials were telling him, you know, his team were time wasting, and they had to they had to be quicker about how they got the play going again. And he was saying, yeah, but they don't understand how I'm away at Spurs, big club, I'm a small promoted club, we have to set up a certain way, and you know that my goalkeeper has to wait to see where he's going to distribute the ball to. That waiting to see how the field unfolds is as much down to Spurs as it is to Sheffield United. You have to see what the opposition are doing as well from a goal kick. You can't just look at your own players. You have to, both teams have to sort of jockey for their positions that they're in. I think he's got a point. You can't penalise a goalkeeper or a, a club, but just wanting to assess what the field of play looks like before you execute your goal kick. Mm. It's just one example, but I think overall that and you alluded to it earlier. You said Tony, the game will reward more attacking teams now the way it's being officiated. But if you are Sheffield United, what is the world of football actually saying to them? You should find money you don't have. You should buy players you can't afford, and you should play a style of football that you haven't been playing in order to be able to work with the new set of rules. I think it is tipped against a club like them, and I think they did a great job in thwarting Spurs for so long, and for it all to come undone at the end when you feel like it's set up against you. I don't think that's a conspiracy theory. I think there's something in it.
Really like your description of Spurs as bouncy. I think that could be the terminology for Ange Postecoglou's team so far. But Gregor, you kind of seem a bit conflicted about Alisson's view on Sheffield United.
I listened to what Heckenbottom was saying, and I think it sounded like he had a point, but then sort of realised that since the rule change where a defender can come and stand right beside the goalkeeper and he can pass it 2 yards to him and the play is live, a lot of teams do that no matter where anyone else is set up on the pitch. I understand you're saying we want to play it from the back, Spurs are going to be on top of us and we want to see how they're going to press, and that dictates how we play, but that's not quite as true as it once was, because you can play the ball inside the box now. So it's an interesting one.
You're telling them to do that. That's not their style.
He wants to play it from the back. He said that. He wants to play it from the back.
But if you don't, you're being told to do that. Not told to officially, but it's like your tactics are being dictated by the referee.
No, that's what I'm saying. I think that point is undermined by the fact that you can now play it inside the box. You need to be brave to do it, but if you're saying you're waiting to see whether Spurs are going to play, Spurs can't step inside the box, so just play.
See, he spoke. What I found interesting was the way he sort of said he spoke to the officials after, and they sort of dictated the style of how we should play a long ball. Do you know, when you get a goalkeeper and the player gets the ball, he's seeing the options. He's not going to just play it to anybody. Mm. He's looking to see how it unfolds in front of him. So I don't see how you can make a time element on that. But he actually said, I think what infuriated him, that they basically, the referee or the lines, I think it was more the referee, had just said, he's telling me how I should play the style of football, which I found a bit odd, because he had a point. If I would have been Heckenbottom, I would have been more angry with the second goal, the winner, with how they gave away the ball in a certain area when they knew that Tottenham were playing. Look,
equaliser, set piece, and Basham's just been run off for the free header. Like, they've done so much good work, and he's obviously angry about the way they've chucked it.
I know you do the numbers way more than me, Gregor, and the numbers of the game was that Tottenham basically threw the kitchen sink at them from the start of the game, didn't they?
Yeah.
So they were playing the way they ended up winning the game, but they were doing that from the early part of the football match anyway. It was a strange listening to the manager, but I did think he had a valid point how where officials shouldn't be telling you how you play when they've worked on that all week to try and have an effect on Spurs, to deny them, to stop them, which they did.
But what a world where Tottenham Hotspur now have big sing-alongs of Robbie Williams' Angels to Postecoglou's name, their new sort of anthem. Players are swinging on the crossbar, and like there's this like euphoric atmosphere. You're like, hang on a minute, this isn't Spurs. And like, it is.
Nothing wrong with an Angels sing-along, if you ask me. We'll be planning one for the end of season party show. Alison Rudd deciding the guest list as well, given the earlier chat. But
are we going to be on it though?
Yeah, who knows. Maybe we'll be paid to come on. We've got to finish with another team who got a late winner, Aston Villa against Palace, and then we're going to talk about Roy Hodgson, the Crystal Palace manager. Tony, just very quickly on Villa, your old club, what does this say about them? They've got their game in Europe this week as well.
I think we already knew that they are offensively a very dangerous side. I mean, I saw them lose at Anfield 3-0 when I came away that day thinking, oh, Villa look a little bit predictable at times, and Diaby's a good player. Diaby's he is a handful. Leon Bailey's been hit and miss since he joined the football club, and he hasn't even got going yet, Ollie Watkins. You know, Ollie Watkins has been a really good player for Villa over the last couple of seasons. So there are lots of good things about Villa. I wasn't surprised by the result, because I did think before the game, big test for Palace going to Villa Park, because Villa come at you And, you know, we talked about attack-minded football and how, you know, how it pays off that you can get a lot of things, get results out of games. I'm still not quite sure where Villa will be by the end of the season. I feel more just above mid-table because I do...
Do you think they might be a bit inconsistent, like you said, with maybe with Europe as well, not finding that consistency, some of those
Europe
players?
Just on numbers, everyone knows Europe comes at a bit of a price. Mm. And I think Villa will fall into that bracket. But they are... I mean, Villa... You talked about, you know, Spurs. Villa Park's rocking.
Yeah.
And I... That's one thing that managers can give to their fans is when you get the atmosphere at a home game and the fans are buying into everything, as much as it can be toxic when it's on, Villa fans are not surprised at the turnaround. We talked about, we started the programme about Brighton, about not surprised at winning at Old Trafford. Villa fans wouldn't be surprised that Villa turned a game around either.
Yeah.
They look so dynamic now. That's one thing you've got to say.
A lot of pace, isn't there?
So much pace and direct play in the final third. And what a strike by John Duran.
Mm.
Like, you know, one of the ones where the ball's still rising when he strikes it, you know what I mean? He's controlled it, and just because of his agility, he's lashed it into the net before anyone could really react. It was a great strike.
Diaby looks like he's going to be a real handful all season for Villa.
Another exciting game for Villa, but we want to finish with Palace and with Roy Hodgson. Obviously taken ill before that game. Alison Rudd, you interviewed him on Thursday. I'm not casting aspersions as to the fact that you've maybe
poison mushrooms?
Giving him a cold or a dodgy cup of coffee. But we hope and we believe that he is okay. Alison, you've spoken to him since doing that interview, so just update us on how he is.
He's fine. Yeah. He's fine, yeah.
He'll be fine. No worries about you coughing on him during
his... And he didn't accuse me of giving him food before, isn't
it? Thank God, because now that means we can talk about your excellent interview. He's a person that you know really well. Throughout your career, you interviewed him on Thursday. He spoke about his love for the game, why he came back to Palace, and some of the exciting players that he's got. I thought it really interesting him talking about the kind of the Palace that was the Wilfred Zaha Palace to the Palace that he's got now and that he's trying to build with the likes of Michael Olise and Eberechi Eze. Tell us a bit more about it.
Yeah, well, he was at pains to stress that both recent stints at Palace he didn't lobby for. They both came out of the blue. And in fact, he said he'd been watching Patrick Vieira's Palace and seeing the young, exciting players that had been signed under Vieira and thinking him and Ray Lewington, because he talks about him and Ray a lot. They're a package, they are. And saying, you know, they would watch Palace and think, oh, well, it'd be nice if we'd had them when we were there because they're so exciting. And then he gets this shock call to go in there. And I was really interested in how do you do that? You know, that they weren't playing to their potential under Vieira towards... They were nervy and not going for it. And the way he did it was, he said to those exciting young players, I will not change my mind. It doesn't matter what happens. I will always want you to do the right thing. And if it doesn't go right, it's my fault, not your fault. Because he said, if you watch a team that has a few bad results... Tactics might change slightly. Players might be asked to be a bit more defensive-minded. And he was saying, I will never, you know, if you're an attacker, you're an attacker, and I will want you to attack, and I will want you to express yourself. So do what you do. Mm. Doesn't matter. You don't worry about what happened last week. You do what you do. And so he's lucky in the sense that he's got players with pace and talent. And if they're told to just enjoy it, as long as they stick to their shape, just enjoy yourself, then... They have a lot of potential. And also, I didn't think he would accept this theory of mine, but Zaha was so much Palace, wasn't he? Everyone, you know, they often couldn't win unless he was playing. You know, if Zaha's not in the team, Palace are going to lose today, was the sort of the thinking behind it. But in a way, him leaving the country, going abroad, it means he's also not a shadow or... The big figure at the club, and it's allowed these young players to come through and not feel they're second rate to Zaha. They can be as influential as him, but instead of just having one player, it's not just Eze, it's not just Elise, there's lots of them who can step in and express themselves more with Zaha not there. Because it used to be, if there's going to be a flashy run or a great bit of skill or someone who leaves a defender on their backside, it'll be Zaha. And now it's a variety of players who can do that.
Do you think that's part of what excites him, the variety that he's got, and not just having, say, one young player or one star player? Do you think that adds to the reason he came back?
Yeah, because he had, I think it was 8 players who were out of contract when he, on his final months at Palace, the first time he was there, that 4-year spell. And it was a really ageing team, and it wasn't going anywhere at all. And it felt like a sort of convergence of an old manager, an old team, time to say goodbye. You've set us up, steadied us for to be a proper Premier League stalwart, but where's it going? And they brought in new players, a new manager. New manager didn't work, but it's a strange mix, isn't it? You've got an old manager with young players, but it works. The players like his knowledge and his advice and his calmness and his ability to say, don't worry, just don't worry. I know what I want, and you don't have to worry about what happened last week.
I want to ask you about your intro to the piece, which is, reads, I have a theory which I put to Roy Hodgson that he was possibly on the cusp of becoming a national treasure but is now instead a cult hero. And you go on to talk in the piece about, during the interview, people coming up and saying hello and things. How do you think he's viewed, and how does he think he's viewed within football?
Well, I put that theory to him, and he did laugh, but he also said more people lately have been coming up to him in the street than used to. And he did think, what's going on? Something's different.
For a chat or just to say, hi, Roy,
yeah, well,
love you.
Just to want to shake his hand.
Mm.
So it's kind of weird. It's as though he has sort of crossed that line and become a national treasure. People I know, okay, you've let the cat out of the bag, at my tennis club. People I know at my tennis club who don't like football, they all know who Roy Hodgson is.
Yeah.
And they all think he's lovely. And isn't it amazing? He's 76 and he's working in management. Everyone, he's crossed that path. He's now gone into almost national treasure. But I must tell you one funny thing. We had lunch in a quite posh restaurant, sort of restaurant where it's not done for the staff. It's not done for the staff to ask for a selfie or acknowledge that you're famous. You know, it was posh. It had a sommelier. That's how posh it was. A sommelier, he wore a suit and had a little badge of a vine so that you knew he was the sommelier. And Roy had a glass of red, but he asked the sommelier to recommend the red. Sommelier went into great detail about which red he should have. So Roy
then
said,
bought the most expensive one.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't. And so Roy said, oh, well, I'll go with the expert. And then 5 minutes later, the sommelier came back and said, was the wine up to, you know, did it fit the bill? And Roy said, yes, it was very nice, thank you. And the sommelier said, I think that particular Pinot Noir does a job. He does a job a bit like a winger who is attacking but remembers he has to track back.
Oh,
oh
gosh.
My God.
And I'm thinking, really? A glass of wine can be like that?
Alison's thinking, leave the imagery to me, son, all right? Back off.
But it was his way of letting Roy know he'd recognised him.
Right.
And it was his way of having an interaction so he could say later, I talked football with Roy Hodgson, yeah, without breaking the rules of saying, oh, hello, Roy, big fan.
Tony, just very quickly, how do you think of Roy Hodgson within football? Because he's a guy who's been around for so long. And I was reflecting on Alison speaking there and thinking about the episode we did before, an England match with Matt Dickinson and Matt Lawton telling stories about England managers and a particular press conference where Roy Hodgson was translating into Italian for the Italian press. And you remember, you know, I think a lot of modern football fans might not know the Roy Hodgson, who was a bit of a trailblazer, was an Inter Milan manager. How is he viewed to you, someone who's been in the game for a long time as well?
Well, I'm lucky that I've met Roy, and obviously Alison's introduced me to Roy a couple of times. I've been on a platform with him, which I, it probably would have been a year or two after he lost the England job. And a fan from the audience wanted to ask an England question. Didn't entertain it, Roy, at all. And I remember thinking, wow, this is a big scar for him, you know. And also being a Liverpool fan, his Liverpool experience wasn't particularly good.
Yeah.
You know, there was a lot of issues for him at the football club, and Liverpool were waning at that particular time. So he's had the bad times, but if you look at his career, you could only admire him for what he's done, how he's handled himself. clearly a very intelligent man. I've been lucky to sit alongside Roy at a dinner table, chatted to him, great knowledge about many different things. Appreciate that. So I've always, I've sort of changed my, if I would have been a pundit and not really met Roy, I would have probably argued differently, but then have had the advantage of sitting with him, listening to him, understanding, you know, the levels of football he's managed at, different issues in different countries, and being abroad myself and, you know, being a manager and speaking many different languages. There's a lot of challenges there that Roy has overcome. And the only thing I would say on Roy, I'd love him one day just to come out openly and honestly about England, because I think it sits really badly with him because of the way he acted on that particular night.
Oh, I would disagree. I did an interview with him and said,
yeah, but you're always favourite. He's always really nice to you.
It was in the paper. He did accept all the things that had gone wrong.
But so, okay, on the night that we did the forum and a fan asked him a question about England and he had a downright refusal to not even talk English.
He probably just didn't like the way it was phrased. He probably thought it was a bit cheeky. I can't remember how it was phrased.
Just on this topic as a final question, Alison, obviously, as Tony's saying, you know him very well, you've interviewed him lots of times. I often wonder with managers and footballers, is what we see on telly, what we see in the press conferences, what we see on Match of the Day, is that the full Roy Hodgson, or are there bits that he keeps back and always will keep back from the public, from the normal football fan?
You don't know. In the post-match press briefing, you see quite a lot of him, but not the whole him. Mm. No. And in fact, while we were talking, it's interesting. I just said his success at Palace has been about asking the players, telling them, proving to them you don't have to play with fear. And he did say over lunch, I said that to the England players. Mm. And it's much easier said than done. You can tell players, please don't play with fear. And he said, but they did play with fear. And it's hard being an international manager because if you're there every day on the training ground, you can really convince the players that you mean it. But the England players, they've spent hardly any time with their international manager, and it's very hard for them to believe him telling them that. Is any way that can be bigger in their lives than how they feel deep down about the pressures of playing for England? So I do have sympathy for how you come in as an international manager and you try and change a culture, and
makes the job Gareth Southgate's done.
Southgate has been given time to do it, and he's actually, if you think about it, he's been quite indulged. But he managed to, I think he had enough results running parallel with him trying to change the culture. But I still think when you watch England sometimes, I still think those players are way down. They don't play as freely as they do for their club.
It's a fascinating interview. You can read it on the Times website now, along with all the reaction to the weekend's games. We're going to have to leave it there, guys. Thank you very much for joining me, Gregor Robertson, Tony Cascarino and Alison Rudd. If you like the podcast, make sure you're subscribed and make sure you go to thetimes.co.uk/thegame for our latest subscription offer to all the best journalism. We'll be back on Thursday.
VoiceOver describes what's happening on your iPhone screen.
VoiceOver on. Settings.
So you can navigate it just by listening.
Books. Contacts. Calendar. Double tap to open. Breakfast with Anna from 10 to 11.
And get on with your day. Accessibility. There's more to iPhone.
Small details are big surfaces. Tight corners are odd shapes. Flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.